Bonjour, mon ami. I am your host.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the second ever episode of Old Geek, Young Geek, the podcast where a couple of geeks talk about video games and other geek-related items. I am Stephen Johnson.
It's okay. I'm just making dumb jokes. I'm Scott Pell.
That's Scott Pell. I'm Stephen Johnson, and we're a couple of nerds of different ages. I'm the old one. I was playing video games back when the VCR hadn't been invented yet.
I was going to ask you how you could play games on cassette tape. Like, did you have to rewind it, like, with a pencil at times?
No, the games were not played off the cassette tape. The programs were loaded from a cassette tape because there were no hard drives. And I didn't even have a floppy drive. I mean, it was before any drives. It was just any older geeks that happen to be listening to this and had to go through this will relate to the pain of, number one, having to get the volume to be exactly right or it wouldn't load correctly. And number two, if there was a speck of dust or if the tape got crinkled a little bit, you could never play your game again.
Oh, no.
It was sad beyond belief.
Oh, that's awful.
The dark ages.
Anyhow, on to the news.
Yes, the current news in 2015.
Yes, for the week of March 3rd, I think.
Yes. So yeah. What do you think the biggest story this week was for you?
For me, it was definitely Leonard Nimoy's passing.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was last Friday, and it was very sad. I personally am not a Star Trek fan, but Leonard Nimoy, like, Spock is universal. You recognize Spock.
Nah, and I don't think there's anybody who doesn't like Spock.
Right, exactly. And so over the weekend, me and my buddies, we watched Wrath of Khan.
Oh, that's an awesome movie.
It was an awesome
movie.
Does it
hold up? Did you like it?
No, I did. It totally holds up. The pacing is really well done. Khan was an amazing villain. Just crazy. Kirk shouted Khan, and it echoed throughout space.
That's the best. Khan!
Khan!
That is the best.
And yeah, and then Spock sacrificed himself.
He just died. That scene must have been just devastating. Oh my god.
Oh, it was heart-wrenching. And then they had the funeral where they he gave his speech, and you know he was bursting into tears, and then they launched Spock into space.
Oh, that's right. Oh.
Yep, and that was the movie. Afterwards, we talked about it over smoking pipes and a game of chess, and it was very sad.
There you go. Well, that guy, that Leonard Nimoy, such a class act right from the start. I mean, just everything that
totally.
The guy did was classy. Like, the photographs that he took were so awesome. He was a great photographer and, you know, like a spokesman for science, and he appeared on The Simpsons.
Spokesman for science,
man.
Representing all of science.
Yes.
Leonard Nimoy.
He supported science. And
he totally
logic.
Did. Like, he did voiceover. He did voiceovers for like those videos that we watched in class for us 90s kids. Like, there's like, you know, Secrets of History or whatever, and they were narrated by Leonard Nimoy. So, like, he was a scholar, he was an actor.
In Search Of.
Yes.
In Search Of was a 70s show that those were probably based on. And again, narrated by Leonard Nimoy, but it didn't really stick to the scientific subject. It was always be about, like, In Search Of, is Bigfoot real? And then Leonard Nimoy would narrate about Bigfoot. Are UFOs invading the Earth? So,
maybe, I don't know. Tell me more, Leonard
exactly.
Nimoy.
Exactly. When Leonard Nimoy said it, you could believe it. If you'd be like,
oh yeah,
several Bigfoots have been spotted.
Yeah.
Bigfoots is the plural of Bigfoot, by the way.
No, or maybe not big feets.
Big feet.
No. No, it'd be Bigfoots because Bigfoot is a proper noun. And, yeah. But enough about grammar and syntax.
Grammar and crypto monsters.
Yeah. What else is going on in the news, Steve?
Well, just today, the big news broke about Maxis. And that EA has shut down Maxis once and for all. They're going to keep the brand, but the studio known as Maxis is no more.
That's awful.
I know. It really is.
That's so bad. Like, I have a lot of good memories playing a lot of different games by Maxis. I played the original SimCity.
Right.
I played some of the offshoots of SimCity and other Sim games. Streets of SimCity was one, which was just ridiculous, but it was fun. SimCopter was another one.
Oh, I love SimCopter.
Right? Yep. That game was so cool.
That was an awesome
cool.
game.
It totally was. And let's see. SimCity 2000. It was a cool thing because you could integrate like SimCity 2000 into those other games, Streets of SimCity and SimCopter.
Right.
Like, you could build a city and then explore that city with your helicopter or your car. And it was just so cool.
That was actually really amazing.
That you could do that. And then they released The Sims. And The Sims was a big thing for me and sort of my family. So me, my brother, and my two cousins would start a house. And we would just kind of, like, play it, like, all day. Like we would basically play it in shifts. And we would manage the family sort of group of people that we made. And that was fun.
Right.
I mean, because it was an interesting concept for like gaming on the whole, because most games were like action, like the major games at that time were like Quake or Doom or what have you. And here comes this.
Yeah. You know, a lot of times I feel like The Sims doesn't get its due in the gaming world for as revolutionary as it was, just because it's not a hardcore game and it has a different appeal and a different marketing base than most of the games that people regard as the seminal titles. But if you think about how it expanded the market of games and how it expanded the audience of gamers, I mean, it can't even be overstated what a huge game it is. And also what a huge risk they were taking when they made it. I mean, when EA put it out to begin with, given the climate at the time where hardcore games were what was selling, for them to put out basically a dollhouse game, and they were putting a lot on the line when they put out the first Sims game. And it's kind of amazing that it was so successful, and it's awesome.
Yeah, and it worked. It worked so well because, like, anybody could play it. My mom played it. My mom doesn't really play games. And, like, you know, like, it's just such a simple concept, and it was strangely addicting. Like, you kind of had, like, you connected with these Sims on a certain kind of level, and it was just kind of fun.
It's true. Like, I really enjoyed the first Sims game, and I used to play it a lot. But then my then-girlfriend, who became my wife, said to me one time, I was showing her around my Sim house, and she said, "Hey, Steve, why don't you just, like, fix up our house?" And I was like, oh, yeah, I guess I could do that. So I think that's another, like, age versus young people thing. You know, when you live in your parents' house, you're like, well, when I have my own cool house, it's going to have all these cool things. But, like, I had a house.
Yeah.
It was an apartment, but still.
Right. Well, who cares?
Yeah, exactly. I haven't kept up with the series all this time, but, you know, I understand the stuff that they're doing is still pretty interesting. A little black mark on the Maxis record, though, I would say, is the last SimCity game, which had such great possibility, and so many things were so good about it. But it just didn't completely gel, and I wonder if that has something to do with what with the sales, which many people considered to be disappointing. The things that are good about it are so good about it, but then when the things that are not good about it come up, it's just like almost heartbreaking because the possibility of it is so right in your face, but to have it not realized is not fun at all.
No, and
did you play that game at all?
I didn't. I just heard of the horror stories of the what is it called? DMR or
oh, the DRM. Yeah,
the DRM where you always have to be connected to the internet.
See, that didn't bother me that much. That was not what bothered me about it.
I mean, like, it's not really an issue because everyone has internet, or at least everyone like who you know has a gaming PC, you know, that could run that has to have internet. But the problem was that, like, none of the servers were connecting.
Right. Yeah. At the beginning, it was harsh. Yeah.
Right. So, like, people couldn't play the game that they wanted to play because it just wasn't working. And that's a shame.
Right.
That's a gosh darn shame. And, like, it was broken because of that feature.
You know, that's kind of indicative of the whole experience of the game, or at least it seems to me, because it just seemed the intentions were all so good, but they just, like, it wasn't finished or something. Maybe it wasn't that it wasn't finished. It's just that they that their reach exceeded their grasp. I mean, there are times playing that game when, more than any of the other Sims games, it really feels like there are really people who live in your city. Like, the simulation is so detailed and so complete, but then there's other stuff where you're just like, why would you have done this? And a lot of it was that they bolted on. The appeal of the original SimCity was, it's, you know, a civic planning game. You have to plan a city like a civic planner would, and it's perfect at that. But The Sims, the new SimCity, the big innovation was this sort of injection of capitalism. So you would have industries that you could start, and they were, which, number one, doesn't make any sense at all, because city governments don't usually also run casinos and mining firms.
No.
But it also, it broke the game itself, because the original game, you were balancing the taxes that you could charge people versus the services that you could provide them. But the new SimCity, you quickly realize that the best way to play the game is to only focus on the industry and don't even worry about all the civic planning stuff, because you can make so much money so early with the industry that the whole game is sort of broken. Like, the whole point of playing it becomes broken.
Yeah.
So, And plus, the cities had such a small size.
That was another thing too, is that there was a size restriction to your city. Like, if I'm expanding and my city's booming, like, get out of my way. Right. I'm making a metropolis here. You can stick to your little suburbs and, you know, just exist, or be, you know, plowed by my corporations and commercial industries. Like, sorry, you can't live there anymore. I'm putting in a supermarket.
And they tried so hard to. They tried so hard by making the maps have other cities and the cities interact with each other, but it didn't quite work. Like, I tried for a really long time. I was like, well, I just want this city to be the casino city and the entertainment city, and this city is where everyone lives, and this city is where everyone works. Like, which seems to be a pretty viable, but you can't really do it that way. Or I wasn't able to. Maybe you can, but I wasn't able to.
I don't know. I didn't play it, so.
So I think that's probably why Maxis is closing, but it's still, or part of it anyway, but that's still a very sad thing.
It is, and... Yeah, you will be missed, Maxis.
That's true.
You'll be missed.
I met Will Wright once when I first started working in gaming, and I interviewed him, and I am going to brag for a little bit, because I asked him a question that caused him to stop and say, that's a really fascinating question, and to give me a really long answer. And the question that I asked him was, I am unable to create a socialistic city in SimCity. Were you commenting on capitalism versus socialism in the design of the game, or am I reading too much into it? And why am I unable to create a socialist? Why can't I make taxes 80% and also provide such great services that people will be happy to pay that much? And he off the top of his head, gave an impromptu lecture about capitalism versus communism and socialism, and explained that it wasn't a commentary, because SimCity starts as its basis with capitalism as the monetary system, and that you could make a different kind of SimCity that started with socialism as its basis, but this was not it. And I just thought that was the greatest answer, and he was the nicest guy for even putting up with such a ridiculous question. I was like, wow, all right.
No, that's a fascinating question. I'm fascinated by that, and Well, I mean, you can use mechanics as metaphor to explain that sort of thing. And if they would have given you the freedom to create a socialistic city, that would be certainly something. And, you know, you could, had they given you that freedom to do whatever kind of city you want, that'd be really awesome.
It might have been an interesting way for the series to have changed, as opposed to just bolting on the shit that didn't work particularly well.
Right.
You know, like
if
they had said, well, let's change the economic assumptions at the center of the game and see what would happen then. Maybe that would be a different way you could do SimCity and make it still relevant. Although maybe there is no way to... Although I don't know, man. The last SimCity had such promise. It was so heartbreaking that it wasn't able to live up to it.
Yeah, I think it was sort of the reach exceeding the grasp thing that you mentioned.
Totally.
Yeah. So... Well, rest in peace, Maxis.
Yes. Sad. How about the great Myst, though, that we talked about last week? We were going to play Myst, and I know you and I both had very different experiences playing Myst.
Yes. I'd like to start because I was really fascinated by this game. So I've never really played Myst. I think I was at a friend's house once and they had it running, and I clicked on a few places and I ended up going into this door that I apparently wasn't supposed to. This guy turned around and he said, "Oh, you arrived." And then he shot a disc at me and I died. I don't remember if that was actually if that was Myst or something else, but that was my understanding of Myst, and I was just confused.
Right.
So yeah. And like I said in the last episode, like, I just kind of collect classic games. And so, like, I bought Myst on a Steam sale. I think it was, like, $1.25 or something like that. I'm like, ah, sweet, Myst. This is a classic. Right. So I bought it. I downloaded it. I tooled around with it for, like, a half hour. I'm like, I have no idea. So I just shut it down. And then, you know, come the podcast, and I, you know, challenged myself. I'm like, I am going to play this game to its end. I'm not going to look up a walkthrough. I'm going to take notes, and I'm going to figure this out. And that's exactly what I did, until it crashed.
Oh, that sucks.
It totally sucks, because, like, here's a situation. Like, I'm just going around, and I'm exploring, and I'm, like, picking up, like, these notes that I find along the way, and, like, I'm exploring these buildings, and I'm figuring out these puzzles. Like, oh, it's a weird slidey thing. That's weird. Okay, well, cool. So, like, I just, like, take note of that. Like, okay, so this place is an observatory, and then I find this one other place, and, like, this place is a library, and there's books, and I can read the books, and I read the books, and, like, I take notes of, like, significant events that happen in the books. Like, okay, this is the age of Channelwood. This is the age of the rocks. And so, like, I do that. Like, I see, like, some other stuff. And, like, there's, like, a tower that you can rotate. I only got to the first island. This is the thing, though. Like, I couldn't get off the first island because I know there's more. I've seen screenshots, and it's really disappointing because, like, I want to go there. I want to explore. I want to solve puzzles there because I knew that that more puzzles awaited me, and I was really excited for that. But, like, it was just my curiosity and, you know, discovery that was driving me the entire time because, like, okay, so I found some sort of note about 59 volts. I'm like, huh, that sounds interesting. And so, like, I find this power generator room. And so, like, I take note of, like, all the buttons. Like, this button equals this many watts, and this button equals this many watts. So, like, you know, I put the numbers so that, like, both dials are at 59. And then, like, I can get into the spaceship. And the spaceship has, like, a keyboard and, like, a slider thing with music sounds that it makes. And, you know, I'm just figuring all this stuff out. And then I get to the clock tower. I'm like, okay, I saw something, like, when I rotated the tower over the gears, there was a weird, mysterious note in the tower that said 240, 221. I'm like, okay, what does that mean? I don't know. But then I get to the clock tower. I'm like, 240, there's a clock, and I can rotate these things. So, like, I get into the clock tower, and I pull the lever, and it locks up. And I'm like, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? Because, like, the mouse wasn't showing up on the screen. Like, I couldn't, like, close the window of Myst.
Oh.
So I had to restart my computer. The thing is, like, I got a nice computer. I got a really powerful computer. Like, I got, like, you know, I got, like, 8 gigs of RAM. I got a really high-end graphics cards, a really nice processor. Like, this is built for gaming. And, like, it was just too much for Myst to handle, apparently. Something of that ilk. Like, I think it might have been because, like, I'm on Windows 8.1 or whatever.
Right.
But, like, it was just too much for Myst. And, like, okay, that was just a fluke. So, like, I restart my computer, and, like, I start off Myst again. I go back and I solve that puzzle. Because, like, the thing is, like, Myst is such a free format game that you can go anywhere and solve any puzzle if you know it, because it won't interrupt anything. It won't, like, you know, you won't jump the gun on something, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah.
Like, that was a really cool design element. So, like, I go back to the clock tower and I lift the bridge up again by inputting 240, and then I go back to that same lever, pull the lever. It freezes again. Oh, no.
That's the worst.
It is so terrible because I was just having a blast. I was discovering things. I was making connections. I was taking notes, Stephen. I was taking notes. Yeah.
That's
something. No, like, you don't do that in video games.
No, not anymore. You sure don't.
Not in modern games. And, like, I was having so much fun just discovering things. I was curious. I was really curious about the places that I had read in the books. I was curious about this island that I was on. Like, what is this place? And what are these notes that I'm finding mean? Like, what are all these artifacts? What are all these, you know, what is this? And I just had so much fun discovering that. And for that to just end, not of my own volition, that sucks.
Okay, let me ask you a question. The version of Myst that you were playing,
was it the Masterpiece Edition?
Was it like the original version?
It was Myst the Masterpiece Edition, okay. Which was the one that was recommended.
Okay, does that mean to get from one location to another, did you have to walk? And did you have the option of looking around at different stuff? Or was it just a set series of pictures?
It was just pictures.
Okay. See, I think this is why we had a different experience with it. Because okay. I downloaded okay. the version that is available on the App Store to play on an iPad.
Oh, okay.
And it is, I forget what version of it is, but they had attempted to enhance the game by making it more like where you had to walk from one place to another and you had free-looking mm-hmm. camera so you could look around at different stuff. And all of these things that were meant to enhance the game, I felt, took away from it. Because I don't mm-hmm. want to have to walk around. Like, it's a big pain. Yeah. I just want to go from one location to the next to get from puzzle to puzzle. So yeah. there was that, which I had to kind of figure out. Anytime you're doing a first-person game on an iPad, it's not going to be the best because the controls are not going to be the best. And so that was kind of sucky. And then going from that to the first, sort of one of the first rooms that you get to is the library. Mm-hmm. And I'm reading all the different books, and I'm going, okay, well, all these books are important, but I don't have any context for any of this information. And, man, there's a lot of books, and there's a lot of things written, and, you know, I got other stuff that I should really be doing. Well, let me concentrate on this, this book says about the different ages. Oh, I should really vacuum, because, you know what, I got to put this away. So I had to put it away, and I honestly think if it had just been the original version, I would have felt better about it, because I... The stuff that isn't solving the puzzles and collecting the information, like walking around is not really what Myst is good for.
No, and that's the thing. Like, it was just click, go to a landmark, click, go to a landmark, click, go to a landmark. And it was just that sort of instantaneous travel. Like, you were going to like key points along the path, like turns and forks in the road and such. And, you know, to have like a normal walking speed, that would seem to impede the flow of the game. But like a lot of the game, at least from the first island experience, which apparently none of us got past that.
Right. Yes, I definitely did. I didn't get past the library because I went to go vacuum.
Right. There were four books that you had to read. And, I read each one of them cover to cover. I took notes on like the different illustrations and drawings and stuff like that. And just like I just made sure like I had all the information possible.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really cool experience just to like go on this adventure. Like if you're going to go on an adventure in real life, like bring a pen and paper and like, okay, so at this time, you know, just like take note of like stuff. And like, it was again, like that discovery. And I loved that. That was a really cool experience.
You know,
it was a really cool experience.
I totally get what you're saying. And, I like that kind of game sometimes and other times I don't. And I recognize the huge influence that Myst had. Because one of the best games that I've played recently, or one of the most interesting anyway, is called Device 6. Have you heard of this Device 6 game?
No.
I would say it was heavily influenced by Myst. It's an iOS game, so you know if you don't have an iPad or iPhone, you're out of luck. But it's interactive fiction connected with puzzles, and all of it is presented in sort of really... innovative ways, but also definitely owing a huge debt to Myst, which was the first of the great sort of interactive fiction games. So,
yeah, for sure.
But again, like one of the things that we had talked about this a little bit that I felt like Myst did wrong was, I don't know, not wrong. I'm going to say, oh, sorry about that. I'm going to say differently. Myst doesn't give you context for the information that you are presented with in the beginning. Like you're just dropping it. And
right.
if you're like me, I don't like that in fiction. I don't like it in games. It's okay at the very beginning for a very short time to not sort of understand the context of the information which you're being given. But after a while, I just end up going, yeah, no. I'm out. I'm done.
Like what's my motivation for being here? And you know, Steven, this is a good segue into our topic of the show, which is storytelling in video games.
That's true. Okay. Fantastic.
Hey, how about that?
So do you think that Myst didn't do a good job telling a story because of the fact that there was no context?
Yes. Yes and no. Because I didn't understand who my character was. I didn't know why I was there. I didn't know much about where I was. And, you know, that was part of the game itself. The storytelling was kind of like a mechanic. Like, who am I? Where am I? And I'm discovering this place, and I'm just sort of like figuring things out. But I really didn't understand why I was doing these sort of things, because, like, I didn't know who I was and my sort of place in the world. It just kind of, I don't know, it was strange to me. Mm-hmm. It's a lot different from modern games, and I'm a huge fan of modern games and the way that they present their stories and the way that they sort of, you know, have their narrative set up, and it's in really big, it's out there in the open, and I understand the context for all of this. Meanwhile, Myst, and frankly a lot of older games, just kind of throw you into it, like, go
right.
And yeah,
well, what about something like Minecraft? I mean, that
well, but there's no story to Minecraft. Minecraft
I don't know.
Is
I don't
more
know that that's so though. I mean,
well, I mean, like, not anymore. Like, they've changed it around to, like, there kind of is a story, but Minecraft is more of a tool that it's more of a creative experience than it is an actual, like, game. I mean, it's okay for games not to have story, but Myst seems such a game that, like, there's lore and there's a world and there's an entire universe, but I don't understand my place in it.
Yeah,
Minecraft,
you're right.
Minecraft, on the other hand, is just kind of like a toy. And I mean that in, like, a really good way, because, like, it, you know, a lot of kids these days play Minecraft, and that's great. That's a fantastic thing that they play Minecraft, because Minecraft allows them for freedom of expression and creativity, and I adore that. I absolutely love the fact that it gives these kids a chance to explore, it gives them a chance to create and figure stuff out, because, you know, you figure out the mechanics of the game, like, okay, so this is an iron block, how do I use this? Okay, I gotta put this in the furnace, and that way I can get an iron ingot, that way I can make steel stuff, I can make iron tools, I can make iron armor. And they just sort of figure out and discover, and they watch, you know, people on YouTube play, they go to the wiki and figure out how to, like, create stuff and, like, learn all about this game. And then that experience is similar to Myst, because, like, they're figuring stuff outside of the game, like how I figured stuff outside of the game by taking notes. Mm-hmm. And that's a cool thing. That's a really cool thing. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about stories in games.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, modern games really do a good job and put forth a big effort, at least the ones that are more focused on storytelling. They do a good job of creating a story. Now, I'm a huge fan of BioWare games, and I talk about them all the time, and I love Mass Effect. Have you ever played Mass Effect?
Oh, yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
Those games are fantastic.
Those games are fantastic, and they're fantastic because of their story.
Yeah.
You get so wrapped up in the story of Shepard versus the Reapers. You get so wrapped up in the universe of Mass Effect. You know, like, the cultures, the histories, and just, like, all the different, like, social customs of the different alien races. Completely useless information, but you're wrapped up in this world. Like, oh my gosh, the Asaris, they're, like, monotheistic, and they're all one gender, and they are pretty much, like, the start of this great galactic civilization. They live to be 1,000 years old. This is all true stuff that's inside the game. Completely useless outside of the game.
Totally.
But you love it. You love that game, and you love that universe.
And you know what that kind of brings us back to?
Yeah.
Mr.
Yeah.
Leonard Nimoy and Star Trek, because if Mass Effect is like
yes.
anything, it's like Star Trek.
It's like Star Trek, yeah. if anything else. And
because, like, that the whole, especially Mass Effect 2.
Yeah.
That one,
oh, dang,
that game is so fantastic.
Best.
But just
that's the best.
Just like the whole middle section of the game where you're just, like, going to different planets. It's just like,
oh, yeah.
I was like, I am like William Shatner. I am Kirk.
Yeah, I am totally Kirk. And you could totally Kirk it up with the ladies of the crew. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. I have a few things to say about the ladies of the crew, but that's probably for another episode. we'll talk about you know, women in games, I'm sure, at some point throughout this podcast. But you know, Mass Effect, like, it was great to just explore, and, like, you know, Edie would say, like, anomaly detected, like, oh, what's this, an adventure? Why, thank you. There was this one time when I was playing, and, like, I found this secret hidden base, like this Blue Sun's outpost that was a trap. There was a distress beacon, and like I went in there and had like one of the best gunfights I've ever had in the game. Like I've already beaten the game like 100%. I've gotten all the achievements and I've beaten it like 3 times before, but I'm just like trolling around on like my 4th run through, and like I found this secret thing, and then like, you know, I take out all the Blue Sun's mercs and I, you know, hack their data or whatever just to see what they got, and then like I get like another distress call like just outside an orbit. There's this material pirate ship about to launch nuclear missiles on this civilization, this small little outpost at this colony, and like, so like I get on my ship and I head over to that and I take out all the Batarian pirates, and like I have to make a choice. Do I direct the missiles towards the spaceport or to the colony where all these people are? And like, do I let them know like, hey, get out of there, or hey, get on the ships, or stay away from the ships or whatever? Like, I had to make that choice, and like that all happened within like some random encounter. This wasn't even part of the main story, but right. Like that was part of it, and that was just a great little thing. Like there was a cool arc there. There was a cool story that happened within that random thing, and that was awesome. and there was like moral choices, and it, like stuff happened, and it was great.
You know what my pick is for best story game? Fallout 3.
Really?
Yeah, because I thought that the overarching plot was very, very interesting, and the way you could make choices within that structure was sometimes amazing. Like sometimes had that great thing where it felt like, no, this is really a little world that is in here.
Yeah.
I mean, you know it isn't, but at some part of you, like it seems real. And for me, the illustration of that did it best was, do you remember that there was in the world of Fallout 3 a tower? And the tower was populated by rich people who wouldn't let the zombies or the mutated people into their tower because they were rich people and they were prejudiced. And you could side with either side. And or, you know, you could either wipe out the people or you could wipe out the mutants. Or if you worked really hard and you wanted to go that extra step, you could get them to come to some agreement and let the people and make the people let the mutants into their tower, which is awesome enough in itself that there's those three outcomes. But what pushed it for me into total brilliance was that was my favorite mission. And about 3 weeks later in game time, I said, hey, I'm going to go back to that tower, you know, that I already completed. And when I got there, the mutants had killed all of the humans. And I talked to them about it. I was like, why did you do this? And they were like, we wanted to take all their stuff. And I was like, wow, that is the best. I thought I had made like the morally correct choice, but it turns out that it was a mistake and that the rich humans were totally right. And they should have kept the mutants out of their tower, and I should have murdered all the mutants.
Oh, wow. That's
so that sort of that's blew my awesome. Mind. I was like, oh
that's,
my God.
That's really awesome that they... that the developers put that in the game, that was a thing that happened.
Exactly. And there's no there's no reason at all that any player would ever go back to that tower or find out that happened.
Not at all.
Like there's nothing that points to it.
Right.
But just but like, they still put that in there. Fantastic. I also like that in the beginning of the game, if you want to play it like totally murderously and blow up the main city, the first city that you get to, you can do that super early into the game, and that essentially destroys every thread to the plot.
Right.
So you have the option of just destroying the entire plot, and then your mission will just read "Find your father," and you have no way of finding him.
Right.
I mean, he is there though. If you do find him,
yeah.
Which I just that sort of blows me away that they had created such diversity of action within one narrative.
Mm-hmm. And the thing is, like, you know, you have these choices to change the narrative. But all of that is still existing within the game. Like, you don't screw up the game because you blew up that city. You still have the option to find your father and complete the main narrative.
Right.
In Mass Effect, you don't really change the narrative at all. Like, you can be a jerk and, you know, kill off certain members. You can lose members of your crew. But it doesn't break the game. You have agency, of course, but... you know, it's just cool that the developers put in those nice touches, like the mutants killing those guys, or, you know, your ability to continue on the entire Mass Effect trilogy with the choices that you've made in previous games.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, the choices would carry over into the next games. I forgot
which
about
is
that.
Which is something that I've always wanted from a video game. Always wanted from a video game. And so when Mass Effect 2 did that, I was just blown away. Like, this is the best game ever.
Right.
Oh, wow. Because, like, when you get to T'Chanka, the homeworld of the Krogans, and your buddy Rex is ruling over Clan Erdnot, you're like, ah, yes, you lived, and you now you're a ruler, you were a mercenary, now you've got a head on your shoulders, you got responsibilities. Rex, I'm so proud of you, buddy. Because Rex was my dude. Garrus and Rex were my crew. We rolled throughout the galaxy just laying waste to anything that stood in our way.
See, I like the girl with the tattoos. I forget what her name was.
Jack.
Yeah, that's who I like. She was my favorite.
Oh, I didn't like Jack. because like, it was like BioWare discovered what curse words were. And they just... you know, use that new knowledge all on that one character. Like, I had never heard a video game character swear that much.
That's right. I totally forgot about that. Yeah.
Oh, my. How could you forget? That was her entire vocabulary. It's like, Shepard, what the fuck is up? I'm like, jeez, get off my ship.
See, I liked her. I don't know.
She was.
See, those cool psychic powers. She was cool.
Yeah, so did my Asari Justicar.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. I mean, like, games and storytelling, like, you know, we're just kind of, like, swapping stories about, like, you know, different experiences that we've had in video games. And, like, they've crafted, you know, these well-written characters, these well-written story arcs. And, you know, games, you know, give us this option to, you know, kind of create our own narrative, like with Mass Effect or Fallout 3. And sometimes, like, linear narratives have come a long way as well. One game that I think of in particular is Spec Ops The Line.
Okay, yeah.
And this game, have you ever played that game?
Have you
heard of it?
I played.
Okay. This game, you know, just kind of came out of left field. Like, Spec Ops is an old PC military shooter that was just kind of generic. Like,
yeah,
you know,
it did kind of come out of nowhere, huh?
Yeah, kill all the terrorists and stuff like that. And then Spec Ops The Line comes from the studio Jaeger. And, like, yeah, it just kind of released. And it was really overlooked just because everyone thought it was another shooter. But it was really well done with its storytelling. And it was kind of like a commentary on the modern military shooter, where you're just kind of dropped in, you know, you're kind of given the whole spiel about, you know, stuff is going on, and you play like this, in the game you play this trio of Delta Force operatives who are supposed to, you know, extract civilians from the city of Dubai, which has been destroyed by a massive sandstorm.
Right.
And in the end, you know, your trio of dudes ends up murdering a lot of people.
Yeah, that's right.
And it creates this chaos. Now, in other first-person shooter games, you know, military shooters like Call of Duty, you murder a lot of people, but that's what you're supposed to do. And in the end, it saves the day. Instead, with Spec Ops The Line, this causes, well, probably what it most likely would, which is a whole bunch of chaos and destruction and terror.
Wait, you mean if you bring an overwhelming military force into the Middle East and then take out the power structures there, that you might end up with a morass of murder and warlords? Because
who would have thought?
Who could have guessed
have
such a thing would happen?
Yeah,
where do they come up with these ideas?
I have no idea. It's something straight out of science fiction.
It's true.
Yeah, I mean, like, that game tells a really good story, and has a really good arc, and you just get engaged with it, and you're just kind of blown away by the end of it. Like, wow, that happened.
Yeah.
And that was a good story.
There you go. I think, like, one of the most interesting things in gaming is the interplay between the narrative and the free will that the characters supposedly have. So I always go back to BioShock as being the best handled version of that ever. That
I guess
when you get there and you find out that you have in fact been on a track the entire time and your character has been too, it's kind of awesome.
And that's kind of what Spec Ops: The Line does.
Oh, yeah,
like, you're on a track.
True.
You're on a track there, but like in the end, like it's corrupting and destroying your character.
Right.
Like it's kind of that same thing, but you don't have a choice in the matter.
Right.
Like you just kind of go along the arc, and well, there you go.
That's the thing is, you never really have a choice in the matter in any game, really.
No.
I mean,
no.
Because that's not how stories work.
No, not at all.
I remember
reading
an interesting interview with Malcolm McDowell about the actor Malcolm McDowell about working on what was that game that he was the space game that he was in that was huge in the 90s. Oh, see, as the old geek, I should definitely know that, but I can't think of the name of it. Oh.
I feel as though you should.
Oh. But he said that he had it was the biggest acting challenge he ever had was trying to read these different lines of dialogue because they were completely different. Like in
right.
one take, he would say, "Oh yes, of course you can have an apple," or the player could choose, "No, you can't have an apple. You suck." And he was like, "How can you make a coherent character who
right.
says these contradictory things?" And I thought that really nicely crystallized the problems that the inherent narrative problems of gaming. And this
yeah.
this is coming from somebody who now makes his living as a screenwriter, which.
Uh-huh.
You know, the importance of story is all important. And thinking about how they must labor over game writing, the free will aspects of gaming,
right.
it just must be like a really, really challenging situation for the writers. I mean,
yeah,
fun, though.
For sure. Yeah, I'm sure that it's fun to write that because, like, if I could ask any kind of like voice actor, I would ask Jennifer Hale, who voices Female Shepard, like which was it more fun to read, like Paragon Shepard or Renegade Shepard?
Right, right.
You know, because like you have to include all of that to create like a wholesome experience. And you know, with Fallout, you have like several different dialogue options, and like you have to you know voice record all the characters who have to respond to that.
Right.
That's crazy. That's insane.
Yeah, it's why though, it's why like in so many games, especially sort of second tier kind of games, the choices
yeah.
are so sort of ridiculous. Like, do
yeah.
you want to give the dog a treat or do you want to kick the dog across the room? And it's just like,
yeah
that's not an interesting moral choice you have
no.
given me because clearly there's
no.
one answer, you know? So,
yeah.
I mean, I guess if you were just a total jerk, you could just be like, oh.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
yeah
I never
mean, you
pick
have
the jerk
lot,
option. There's always a jerk option and I never pick it.
No, I can't really do that either. I empathize too much with the characters.
Yeah, me too.
Like,
if
I play Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic, that's another BioWare game. I play that, try to do the Darkstride run, and that like early on, like there's this situation where these two rich snooty kids are bullying an alien, and you're just like, kids, get out of here, stop being dicks, and then they run off and like. As an option of dialogue when you're talking to the alien that was just being bullied by these kids, like, could you maybe offer some kind of reward for me helping you out? I'm like, oh, no! Don't be that way! That's just awful!
I did play through Fallout 3 after I'd beaten it. I played through it with a character that made all the evil choices, and it was actually super fun. Again, in testament to how great that game was.
Yes.
But I didn't make the jerk face choices. Like, I can play a game as the evil guy, but not the
right.
jerk face guy. Because jerk
right.
face guy just seems like, well, why would I be a jerk to this person? Even if I was evil,
yeah.
why wouldn't I just be like nice to him? I mean,
yeah,
like, why
I mean,
wouldn't I, in a self-serving way, be nice to somebody, you know?
This place deserves a better class of criminal.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. I mean, sure, I blew up the town. I killed everyone
yeah.
in it, but I was nice to them when I visited.
But you were nice to them, even
before
though
I
you...
blew them up, I was very nice to them.
Before you incinerated them, vaporized them. Wow.
I was mad
okay.
that I couldn't kill everybody, that there were plot-specific characters that you can't kill in that
oh.
game. I was like, oh, I just want to
yeah.
murder everybody. I just want everyone to be dead and me to be the last person. But you can't do
yeah.
that, which is sad. You
no.
can kill most everybody, but not everybody.
Most everybody. Oh, well.
And I think
oh,
on
well.
My mass murder note, we should end the second ever version of...
Old Geek, Young Geek.
Old Geek, Young Geek. And this time we both said the name right, which is amazing in itself.
Yes. Well done.
All right,
well
man.
Well done. Good job, us.
All right. Goodbye, Internet.
Goodbye, Internet.
Until
it was
next
good
week.
Seeing you again. Until next week, we will... talk to you again, or you'll listen to us again, hopefully. And if you like today's podcast, let us know. Send us a tweet at oldgeekyounggeek on Twitter, or send us an email at oldgeekyounggeek@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. I'm back, I'm cool, what's our representative on me? No ghost, no 16-bit like Sega Genesis. RG ball on the board, soundtrack on the track, Gemini on the job, Shelly G on the G, set green for the green free chili, and I'm back on my thing for the listeners.